Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. Well, greetings, everybody. Welcome to this week's podcast, Behind the Curtain. I'm WGN-TV's Paul Lisnick, and a mixed podcast we have for you this week, some theater and stuff. But this week, I wanted to start off with a very cool book I came across. I actually saw it on the desk of one of the producers at WGN and saw it and said, I'd love to, can I borrow that? I want to see that. And anyway, fast forward, here we are now. The book is called The Leopold and Loeb Files, an intimate look at one of America's most famous crimes. Depending on your age, you must be familiar with the Leopold and Loeb case. But if not, we're going to fill you in about it. And this book is the creation of its author, Nina Barrett, who has she's a graduate of both Yale and Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern. She's written many books. Her work has appeared in all sorts of entities like the New York Times and the Chicago Tribune. And she, I think most importantly, because I believe in independent bookstores, she's the founder and owner of Bookends and Beginnings, which is an independent bookstore in Evanston, Illinois. You should check it out and say hi to her. Nina Barrett, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I read a little bit as well of the history of how this book came about. I mean, Leopold and Loeb is not a new case. This was obviously something that happened back in 1924, in the 20s. So tell our listeners a little bit about what triggered you to say, you know what, it's time for a new book about this old, fascinating case.
Okay, well, in a way, you know, I just stumbled upon being involved with this professionally. I happened to have a job at Northwestern University Library where I was part of my job was to do public relations for their collections. And they do have this astonishing collection that documents this murder, which is apparently the most well-documented murder in U.S. history. So, and just to briefly summarize what it was this, you know, murder of this 14-year-old boy by these two brilliant University of Chicago students, and then because they confessed to the murder, and everyone thought that they were going to get the death penalty, Clarence Darrow, who was the celebrity attorney of the day, was called in to defend them. So the materials that have survived are a complete transcript of Leopold and Loeb being interrogated in police custody, their confessions to the police, the ransom note that was sent to the parents of the boy they kidnapped, a 5,000-page court transcript in which Darrow steps on stage and produces this incredible rhetorical brilliance that he was famous for. And so Northwestern had all these collections, and so at first I thought, well, let's just do an exhibit because people should know. That was my job. People should know how amazing the collections are. So we did an exhibit in 2009. I was surprised, we were all surprised by the response to it. There was a lot of media attention on the national level and the local level. But I'm going to say that the most haunting response to the exhibit was that one day, two descendants from one of the families, one of the murderer's families, showed up at the exhibit and asked to speak to me. And I thought they were going to be upset because we were bringing this up again. But what they said was that they had grown up in their family, first without knowledge about this case, but then when they found out about it, they were told to never, ever talk about it, because obviously a huge amount of shame had come down in the family. And they were curious, and so they heard that one of the things that we had in the exhibit were the psychiatric reports. Right. So Clarence Darrow had commissioned the best psychiatrists of the day to examine Leopold and Loeb, you know, in terms of whether they were sane or not, or what could have caused them to commit this murder. And so the descendants wanted to know, you know, first of all, was there anything in the psychiatric reports that explained why they had committed the murder? And secondly, they wanted to know, was there anything potentially hereditary?
And by the way, just to, I mean, this report that was found, one of the interesting things, as I'm a lawyer as well, so one of the interesting things to me is this was not the report that ever got admitted into the trial, right?
Well, in terms of the psychiatric report, so that's an interesting story because there were psychiatric reports that were admitted at the trial, and that, in fact, Clarence Darrow leaked to the press, and they were published by and large in their entirety in the newspapers of the day,
right.
And they did not find Leopold and Loeb insane. This was part of, so Clarence Darrow's legal strategy, when everybody thought that the only hope of getting these two guys, saving them from the death penalty was an insanity defense. You and I would just use our common sense to say that two incredibly brilliant University of Chicago students who just decide to murder a 14-year-old boy because they can, sound like they're insane, right?
You would think.
You would think, by definition.
But Darrow did hide one of those reports.
So when he was considering using the insanity defense, because that was what everybody thought was his only choice, so he commissioned these psychiatrists, and they did, in fact, find in an initial report that Leopold and Loeb were both insane. Mm-hmm. Darrow then changed his tactics, and he realized that if there was going to be an insanity defense, there would have to be a jury trial. And he felt, and surely he was right, that a jury of their peers would not be willing to declare Leopold and Loeb not guilty by reason of insanity, because they were too, you know, despite this idea that, of course, anybody who did what they did would be insane, if you heard them talk, they sounded completely sane.
Yeah.
They were never going to convince a jury that they were insane.
Well, let's pull this apart a little bit. I mean, so basically where this goes is Darrow was kind of willing to manipulate that evidence a little bit, as perhaps lawyers uncomfortably do, as he proceeds with his tactic. But I want to kind of, again, let me go back to some of the basics here. So the kid who's killed, his name is Bobby Franks. He's actually related to one of the killers.
Yeah. So the Frankses were related to the Loebs. They lived on the same block in Hyde Park, which is incidentally about a block away from where the Obama house is.
And
now,
Bobby's playing baseball outside, and he's on his way home, and Loeb kind of calls him over to the car, right? And in other words, there's nothing, you know, why would Bobby worry? This is his cousin. And and they kill him quickly, but yet they send a ransom note to the family. This is all part of these two, you're right, you and I would say they've got to be insane, two brilliant guys from University of Chicago, brilliant by definition that they went there, who decide we can get away and we can commit a perfect crime, or let's find out if we can commit a perfect crime.
Right.
Well, it didn't work out for them, and so they do go through the trial. You know, this is history, so I don't think we're ruining it by telling everybody what happened. So what is the verdict at the end for Leopold and Loeb? Because you even say this case is not a whodunit; it's really a why done it. That's really what this is all about. Why did these guys do it?
Right, and so in the end, they are saved from the death penalty. But the reason the case does continue to present questions for us are that we still don't understand why they did it, despite the fact that all of the preeminent psychiatric experts of their day examined them and came up with theories. Darrow's defense of them was very much toward, he really believed there's got to be a reason when people do things like this. We just don't know what it is yet. Science hasn't yet discovered what makes people do something like this yet. But there's nothing. So part of why I end up doing the book, and is that to the extent that we have any idea why they did it, we do have these records of their own words. You know, they're right. narrating the murder in their own words. They're saying why they did it in their own words. The psychiatrist in their own words giving their explanations. And, you know, what I felt like when I read these documents is, well, we have heard this story told over and over in fiction, in nonfiction. Everybody's got their spin on it. Everybody embellishes it. But when you sit down and you read these documents and you hear their words, you really feel like you're in the room with them. And it's chilling.
And what's really cool about looking at something from back then, this is what I loved about the book, one of the reasons it captured my eyes and my attention. It's not, for folks who haven't seen it, first of all, it's a beautiful hardcover book, nicely published. But it's full of, it's not just a narrative book, it's full of photos and copies of the documents. And you really take the reader back to those files to experience as close as possible what you experienced as you held. I mean, that ransom letter, this stuff still exists. This stuff is in files and is still around. This is all the original documentation. And unlike today when things get maybe microfiched and never seen again or discarded, this stuff is all still in existence.
That's right. And I think, to me, the pictures were a very important part of the book because a lot of these are photographs that may or may not have appeared in the newspapers in 1924, but most of them haven't seen the light of day since then. You know, most of the books that have been done on this case in nonfiction either were not illustrated or had, you know, very sort of low-quality reproduction.
Yeah.
These are given full-page and sometimes double-spread play, and you see the faces, you know, they're very haunting. The face of Bobby's mother, who's clearly, you know, just shrouded with grief. And there's a picture of the girl who was dating Nathan Leopold and went out on two dates with him in the week between when he committed the murder and when he was arrested. And, you know, she was, of course, more shocked than anyone else.
Yeah. Now, I know you went through like 10,000 pages of original documents mm-hmm. of all this stuff, yet you come down to a, you know, easy-to-handle book. How difficult was that? I would probably have a book that was 12 volumes long because, well, how do you know what to cut out? I mean, I suppose some things were easy to cut out, but you must have had some challenges of documents you decided maybe not to include, but you really wanted to.
So when I was going through the thousands of pages of documents, it was very much on my mind. You know, I had read the other books, I had seen the other movies, I had read Compulsion, which is the most famous novel based on the case. So it was very much in my mind, like, what are people most curious about here? And so I went through basically with an eye to excerpting the parts that I felt like most addressed the questions that people ask over and over again. You know, did Leopold and Loeb feel any remorse for what they had done?
Did they?
It's a really important question. You know, what was their motivation? Which is a kind of, you know, now whenever there's any kind of a murder now, you know, a mass murder, a high-profile shooting, the first question people ask is, well, what was the motive? You know,
what did you learn? Did they ever regret it? Did they look back and say, what were we doing?
Well, I think as when they were young, at the time of the trial, they showed no remorse whatsoever. And so there are some, I feel, very shocking passages in the book where they're directly asked about that by the psychiatrist. And they're unable to articulate that they feel any remorse. It's a huge question. Of course, Leopold, after serving 38 years, I think, in prison, got paroled. But he made a number of unsuccessful attempts to get paroled in the 10 years or so leading up to that. And each time he had to go before the parole board and try to convincingly express remorse for what he had done. And I read all the drafts of all the parole pleas. And you see him when he finally, you know, gets Elmer Gertz, his new lawyer, who does eventually win him parole. You see how carefully he's being coached by Elmer Gertz in how to sound remorseful. You know, we can't go inside people's souls and say whether they feel remorseful or not. But if Leopold, as he described it, he became in prison a fat bald, middle-aged man. You know, if at that point he finally did come to a point where he really felt remorse, he was very unable to articulate it on his own.
And Loeb, of course, he was killed in prison, right, in the 30s.
Yes, so that was a very sensational killing. He was slashed to death in prison by another prisoner, and who accused him of making a homosexual advance on him. And so there's this famous newspaper lead, which is supposed to be the most famous newspaper lead ever written in history, which goes to that old saying that you are never supposed to end your sentence with a preposition.
Right.
And you know, Loeb was famous for his incredible intelligence. And so supposedly the Chicago Daily News lead about his murder in prison said, despite his erudition, Richard Loeb today ended his sentence with a proposition.
Wow.
But
It's fascinating to read. And so let me just, before I let you go, when, you know, so people read this book now, as I said, I saw it on a desk. I said, I got to check that book out. But I'm a lover of history and I'm a lawyer. And so it reads to me. I want to see it. If you're the average person out there, just sort of, you know, why should they be curious? Why should we look back at that trial from the 20s now?
Well, I mean, as I say, it does go to this question of, you know, why do we, when we cast about so desperately for the motivation of a crime, what are we looking for? I think that we're looking for the idea that normal, quote-unquote, people aren't capable of doing things like that, because it lets us distance ourselves from murder. And I think this case does continue to haunt people because it is a very clear example of not a mistaken identity. It's two cold-blooded killers,
right,
who did it because they could, and that's hard to resolve. But I also think it's about, to me, it's always struck me as a case that calls us to question the whole American dream, because these three families, the two murderer families and the victim's family, were three German immigrant families where they'd come to America with nothing in their pockets. They had made their own fortunes. They'd done everything you're supposed to do. You know, they'd built the big houses. They were sending their sons to the finest schools so that they would in turn take their place in the American elite. And yet there is some kind of worm in this apple where you raise these two sort of young princes to have everything, and they're so smart, and yet you can't, you apparently can't whitewash out dark things that are in the human soul just because you have a lot of money and you have what we think of as success.
But so, you can hopefully learn on them for the future, learn what makes other people tick, and why they want to take these sort of steps. It's an amazing story. In fact, a friend of mine wrote a musical about it called Thrill Me. I know you're familiar with that, Stephen Dolgonoff. And that continues to play all over the world, which is a musical version about this story. So if you're not familiar, listeners, with Leopold and Loeb, the case, you ought to really check out this book. I mean, like I said, it reads great. There's transcripts, there's photos, there's it's like going through the case file yourself, only you don't have to because Nina did it for you. And congratulations. This is just a really cool experience to go through. So I want to thank you for that. The book, again, is called The Leopold and Loeb Files, An Intimate Look at One of America's Most Infamous Crimes. The author is Nina Barrett. I imagine people can get this at your bookstore.
We do have a few copies, but you can get it at any other proudly independent store in the Chicago area.
All right, which is good to know. But check her out as well, and check out Bookends and Beginnings, because we need to support the independent bookstores. I think it's great stuff. Nina Barrett, congratulations on this excellent work. Can't wait to see what book project is up next for you, and I appreciate your spending some time with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Problem, you're the best of yours. It's all your zest.
Yes, great music from a new show playing. Well, new show revisited, new now, been around before, playing over at Stage 773. It is called The Book of Merman. Don't get confused. I didn't say The Book of Mormon. It's The Book of Merman, as in Ethel Merman. It's a scream. It's so much fun. You're going to meet the cast and the guy who wrote the book, the music, the lyrics, and all of that in a great experience, which you can have up until January 6th as it plays in Chicago over at Stage 773. Joining me is the guy that created this whole thing, Leo Schwartz. Leo, we last talked when you wrote your new show, We the People, or otherwise known as the Anti-Trump Musical. This is a revisiting of a show that existed before.
That's right. We had decided to produce it off-Broadway this fall, and I actually wanted to produce it with Flying Elephant Theater to kind of make it our nutcracker. We're hoping that with the Christmas element and just how much fun it is, we could do it annually.
And joining me now is the entire cast of the show, which you can do when you have three actors, and that means a lot of responsibility on them to carry it. And so joining me, let's start with Ethel Merman herself, Nicole Friedman, Nicole, welcome to the podcast, and I'm just curious, depending on the age of the audience, I remember Ethel Merman, I know all about her, as does, of course, one of the characters. But let me ask you, as you get young people to come to the show and all of that, what is your sense of playing this iconic actress that some people are very familiar with and others may not know?
Wow, what a fun question to start it off with. this is probably a hard one for me to answer, though, because having a family who loved musical theater and all of the classic American songbook stuff, I don't remember a time that I didn't know who she was. So it's hard for me to think anyone doesn't know who she is, but obviously I'm not. And then I hope ours is a lovely introduction to her.
Well, absolutely. And people, and of course, we learn a lot from her from one of the other characters. So okay, here's the thing. It's called The Book of Merman, and you're kind of wondering, is that a play on The Book of Mormon? Well, it's not. It's its own thing. But there are Mormons in the show. That's kind of the impetus to this show, is that a couple of Mormons come calling on Ethel Merman. And of course, the hilarity ensues after that. Let's go to the Mormon elder who does know Ethel Merman in the show. The character is Elder Shumway, and he is played by Samuel Massey. So, Sam, let's be candid now, like a therapy session. Were you really familiar with the great Ethel Merman before you maybe got into this role and all that? You're a theater guy, so perhaps you were.
I really wasn't. It's just kind of one of those things. It was a name I had heard, and it was just kind of this this icon of who she was. But I really didn't know much about her, or much about her career even, up until we actually got into this process. It was, yeah, like I said, it was just really a name more than really me knowing who she was as a person. So it's been really fun to really learn who she was through the show.
You see, Nicole, you didn't have to look far to find those people who were familiar with Merman.
Apparently not.
Yes, you just had to look to your left on stage. And playing the other member of the cast, playing Elder Braithwaite, is Michael Idalski. And Michael, your character would be the one who on stage is not so familiar with Ethel Merman, but he does come to love her. Tell me about Elder Braithwaite.
Yeah, Elder Braithwaite is very set in his views and his religion, and he just wants to bring his mission to everyone and anyone. So he can follow his path.
Leo, you have written shows, I'm so familiar with your work, I mean, about Emmett Till. What a serious, incredible story. We the People, as I said, dealing with the politics of the Trump era. A show called Penn. A show called Under a Rainbow Flag. I mean, you, what made you think of the concept of saying, it's time to revisit Ethel Merman, and I'm going to do this by having some Mormons come to her door? I mean, I don't even know how you come up with that.
Well, that's actually the idea of the title was not mine. It was a director here in town who came to me one day and said that he was sitting at a bar downing martinis with someone, and they were laughing. What would happen if two Mormons rang Ethel Merman's doorbell? You could call it The Book of Merman. He said, is there a show there? And I said, well, I kind of rolled my eyes because I don't necessarily like parody, but I thought, let me think about it. So 3 days later, I actually came up with a narrative arc, and I thought, yeah, actually, there is a show here. We could make this entertaining and fun.
And Nicole, I don't want to give too much away because some people might say, well, does this, because Merman died many, many years ago, and some would say, well, then does this show take place in the 70s or something like that? But it doesn't. And so tell us a little bit about your character of Ethel Merman, because it is Ethel Merman, but there's a twist to it.
There is a twist, and I forgot to ask Leo if I'm allowed to talk about the twist.
Let's find out.
We got on this call.
Leo, can we talk about the twist?
Really, sweetie, honey.
Is it okay?
Yes. Spoilers indeed. You know, look at it this way. The moral of the story is not dependent on when on whether or not I am actually Ethel Merman.
Right.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. And it's actually, it's a, if anything, it's the sign of all the characters kind of having a realization about life and what life is all about. And Sam, so you and Michael, you guys are, you know, you're Mormons, you're elders out there, but it looks like your character, Elder Shumway, is kind of never in the, I mean, if either of these characters were going to be in a Book of Mormon type show, I think Shumway might be the guy who might be in that show as somebody who's just, his mind is kind of elsewhere while he's supposed to be doing his job. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, I think you really hit the nail on the head. I think he's someone who's incredibly passionate and very, very energetic about everything he does, but not necessarily about the mission that he's actually supposed to be doing. Yeah, he loves a lot of things. He feels very strongly about many things, but not necessarily what he should be focusing on at the time, no.
And Michael, your character also, again, has an epiphany, and kind of an eye-opening, an awakening, and realizes there's also more to life than just maybe the mission itself.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You want to tell us a little bit about it?
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, I don't want to send any spoilers either. But Braithwaite really learns that while you're focusing on one thing, you might be missing out on others. And so there is more than one facet to life.
For people who are familiar with Merman's music, Leo, there are several songs in the show that are very reminiscent. I mean, you know, Merman starred in Annie Get Your Gun and Gypsy, and you do play with songs that will be familiar to, at least I think they're familiar. I was hearing things kind of reminiscent of other songs. So how did you do that? You got to walk that line. That's the lawyer in me. You have to walk that line between we can do this and we don't want to get sued.
Yeah, I mean that was really a challenge, and so I mean there are aspects of chords and interval choices and things like that I took into account. I mean actually the biggest challenge was I love the Book of Mormon. The score is almost a parody in itself. It's very very effective, but it's very lightweight. So the hardest music for me to parody was the Mormon score. You start getting into the Cole Porter and the Sondheim scores. They're so rich with material that you can pull stuff out and really play with it. So yeah, I mean that's. But I think I did. I mean I did some of these parodies really really well. You know.
Well, I think so. I greatly enjoyed it. And by the way, the show is we ran about 70 minutes or so, 70, 75 minutes.
Yeah, 75 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just a lot of fun just to go through and sit through it. So, Sam and Michael, I'll ask you guys this question. I'm just curious. So, if you know, you guys are younger in terms of actors and stuff. So, did you have what kind of reaction are you getting from your friends, your colleagues, people in your lives who are seeing the show? And are they, too, learning about something they didn't know anything about? Sam, we'll start with you.
I would say a lot of my friends really are. So there's a lot of them who have heard a lot about the Book of Mormon before and have kind of heard of Ethel Merman. But it's kind of the same thing that I was going through. You know, I knew of both of those two things. I knew about the Book of Mormon. I knew about Ethel Merman. But I didn't know a ton of in-depth stuff about either side of it. So I think people coming into this, not only do they get a great message out of it, but they also kind of learn a little bit about an icon of the American musical stage.
And Michael, of course, I know you're surrounded in your other part of your world by theater people. So are they having fun? Are they having fun as they come to see this show?
Yes. Yeah. I think my work environment over at Broadway in Chicago definitely leads to people who are already Ethel fans and know what they're getting themselves into when they come to see the show. I'm excited to see, I'm from Northern Michigan where not a lot of people do know who Ethel Merman is. When I told them I was cast in the show, they thought it was, the Book of Merman as in mermaids. So I'm very interested to see how they're going to respond, when they learn it's not about mermaids and, they get introduced to this new iconic character who I've been in love with for years.
Yes. Can you tell me when they're there so I can talk to these people after the show?
Yeah, absolutely.
We should do another interview with them. It'll be our visit to Michigan. And Nicole, I'm always intrigued when I ask, for example, when I talk to the cast of Cher or you know, where people are playing either people who were alive, like you are, you know, real people like Ethel Merman, as you are, but even people who are playing iconic roles, roles such as the, you know, Pretty Woman, you know, taking on, or Tootsie, and the Dustin Hoffman role. I mean, I think there's extra challenges that come along with it. So I'm just curious, when you got cast in this role, and I'm sure, you know, you're directed in terms of what you're doing, but do you see, is it a burden? Is it a challenge? Is it just a pleasure when you're playing somebody who a lot of people know who it is?
It's truly a unique challenge, for sure. But, you know, one of the things about me is that I have been compared to her since I was a kid, singing and belting out tunes. So that part of it has always sort of been inside of me, and I love that comparison. I mean, what a compliment that is. And as a matter of fact, Leo and our director, DC, when I auditioned, said, are you trying to do an impersonation of Ethel Merman right now?
Sure.
And I was more trying to channel her spirit than I was to do doing a strict impersonation. And indeed, that is what both Leo and DC told me, that they don't want an impersonator. They want to channel her spirit and bring that forward more than anything else.
I have to tell you, I went with somebody who I knew did not know who Merman was. He wasn't born in this country, and he came along, and I said, you know what? What you need to know is this. She was married to a guy named Ernest Borgnine, which was just a disaster. And, in fact, I forgot whose biography it was. Leo, you might know. One of them had the chapter about their marriage to the other one, and it was blank. It was an empty page.
That was her autobiography.
It was her autobiography, okay.
Right.
Yeah, and Borgnine was over there. And I mentioned that. I mentioned Gypsy, and I mentioned the disco album. And I just have to laugh because as every one of those things got addressed in the show, he kind of turned to me with a smile because I'm like, there it is. You know, you really, Leo, left nothing off. Anybody who either knows Merman or just knows a little bit about Merman, you hit those things people know.
Yeah, it was well, and it was fun doing the research. And actually, I'm not much of a reader, but my husband is, and he would fill me in on the facts. He goes, "Oh my God, this is really interesting." And I went, "Okay, we'll write it in the show." You know?
And here comes the song. Well, the show is called "The Book of Merman." Book, music by, well, Leo Schwartz, we should, and DC Cathro, we should give credit there, right? And directed by DC, and also music and lyrics by Leo. And starting, what a great fun cast. I enjoyed all of you guys, which is why I kind of said, you know, let's just get them all. There's three of them. They carry the whole show. They carry it through. Let's talk to everybody, and I'm so glad you guys have joined me. The show is playing. It's playing now, and it's through January 6th at Stage 773. You can get tickets at stage773.com. You can check out the show more at Book of Merman Musical. .com. That's more about the New York run, but at least it introduces you to the show because this is a show that's had a life, will continue to have a life. I think I told you, Leo, a friend of mine had seen it in the past and got me the CD and said, here, you just got to hear this music. And I wasn't sure I'd ever see the show. And there it was, coming back to Chicago. So Sam Massey and Nicole Friedman and Michael Idalski, Leo Schwartz, congratulations. Have a great run, a great time. The rest of you are all Chicago actors, so hopefully we'll see you on stage and something else soon. Leo, I'll wait for your next show to come to the Chicago stage.
Well, thank you, Paul. I look forward to seeing you there.
All right. Absolutely. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Have a great run.
Thanks,
Bye-bye.
Paul.
Thank you.
It takes a great big woman. It takes a big fat woman. No skinny little woman. No diet big woman.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you are a fan of blues, jazz, the divas who sing it, have I got a guest for you. A guest you're going to be able to see coming up, too, on December 19th over at Navy Pier. Lynn Jordan is joining me, and you want to talk about just a woman who just is filled and brims with the blues and that jazz sense and the music of Nina Simone. And anyway, I've just fallen in love with this woman and her music. And I'm going to say welcome, Lynn, to the podcast. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
Sure. Now, the reason you are with me, so our listeners understand, is you are performing as part of something called Sequence Chicago. It's over at Navy Pier. And this is a series of events, actually, that goes on through December 19th. You kind of caps it all off with you. And different talented performers from Chicago will perform. These are free programs. People can come and check them out. It starts, just to put it out there, December 8th. There's a seasonal concert that happens on the Grand Staircase in Navy Pier, which is amazing. And the Chicago Gay Men's Chorus will be singing there. And December 15th, another concert with a Vince Gilardi tribute. He's the guy that did all the Peanuts music and all of that. That'll be near Ben & Jerry's again at Navy Pier. But then on December 19th, it's you. It's an evening called A Blues Christmas. Starts at 7. It's in the Aeon Grand Ballroom, which means you're going to have lots of people. And this is a chance just for you to do your thing, and we got a sense of it just in what I played in. But tell me about the event on December 19th, because it's you, but you've got some friends playing with you.
Oh, most definitely. It's me and a couple of Alligator Records label people. There's Taranzo Cannon, great guitarist, blues singer, band leader, and he's also like a CTA bus driver and truck. It's crazy.
Why not?
He's got a crazy story. He's like a star, but he has his day job. He drives a bus.
I love it.
It's nuts.
And you got Little Ed with you.
Yeah, Little Ed, who's amazing, and Matthew Scholar, who I have known from when I first started singing professionally. Matthew hooked me up with this amazing gig back in the day, like in the 1990 or something. So I've known Matthew for years. And we're all real good, you know, we're all real good friends. We all have a good chemistry. And it's a great lineup. It really is.
So it's an evening called The Blues Christmas, and just hearing some of your music, which, by the way, people can, I think, go to your website. I've just listened to a bunch of stuff that you've done, and I'm just going to guess that we're not, this kind of music is not going to be a traditional, we're not going to be sitting there listening to Jingle Bells the way we learned it as a kid. I think we're going to have a pretty different experience as we spend the evening with you.
There are some holiday-themed songs.
But done your way.
Yeah, and they're all actually, some of them are, I mean, they're not, there's no, yeah, they're, I don't even know if anybody's doing any traditional Christmas, I mean, I don't know if any of that's happening at all. But, I mean, you know, I mean, I know somebody's going to have, like, bells on or something, but, like, I'm singing a song called Stay a Little Longer, Santa, you know what I mean? It's just, like.
Well, that's why I wanted to introduce you with that, you know, great big diva kind of number that you did. You also, you performed in a one-woman, I believe it was a one-woman show, a musical tribute to Nina Simone, sold out in New York, Atlanta, and everywhere you talk. So what?
And Chicago.
Who are your influence?
And Nashville.
Who are your influence? I know you grew up in Ohio. Who are your influences?
My influences are a little bizarre. I mean, they're all over the map because I like all kinds of music. It's very strange. So, of course, Nina Simone is a big influence. But I didn't really start getting into Nina until I started crafting that show. I knew who she was, and one of my cousins had a poster of her from, like, my childhood. So I always knew who she was. And I knew her music, kind of, but I had not, you know, you really have to jump in when you're trying to put together a tribute show, so to speak. So, but she, I call her my spirit animal. I also love Janis Joplin. You know, here we go. I'm all over the place.
Yeah.
Janis Joplin, of course, Aretha, you know. I also love Mahalia Jackson because of how simple her singing was. You know, I'm more of a simple singer. I don't do a lot of runs. You know, I sing very, not a lot of notes.
Right.
You know?
Well, the one name I thought you were going to say was Etta James. I thought.
Oh, I was getting to Etta.
Okay.
Etta James. I loved Etta James. I loved her, you know, her songs and everything, you know, the tunes that she, her, yeah, I'm a huge Etta James fan.
Yeah, because I hear that influence when I listen to you. I don't know why, I just do, so I was curious to ask you. Now, this performance on the 19th in the Aeon Grand Ballroom, it starts at 7 o'clock and with your friends, so, I mean, I just, and it's free, so I can't imagine
how. I know, it's a great concert, and it's free. That's the crazy part.
Yeah,
know?
And of course, the Navy Pier people would like me to probably tell people that while you're there, go ahead and take a ride on the gondolas. Those, I just did it for the first time ever, about a month ago, these climate-controlled gondolas. It's really cool. The Ferris wheel, famous Ferris wheel.
Yeah, right.
and kind of get a view around. So it's a way to just kind of spend the evening at Navy Pier. Great time to do it at Christmas time. And so did you put this group together, this collaboration of you and Taranzo and everybody, or is it a show you guys travel to do, or you're together for this special show?
We are together for this special show. Yeah. So I did not put it together.
Okay.
But it's a great lineup, and like you said, it's a great chance to, because the show doesn't go all night, so you can, you know, bebop through Navy Pier, which is a wonderful spot. Right. So
go down and get some Garrett's popcorn and roam around.
Oh, so much! I love that. I've been singing at the pier for decades. I'm so old, Lord.
Let me ask you, we'll turn to you for a moment. So in the new year, where will we find you? Have any gigs coming up that you can talk about that we can come check you out?
Well, let's see. I'm doing some group shows, and you know, I've written a play, like a one woman show, a solo show where I have a quartet behind me, and then I'm basically doing monologues and singing in between.
Oh, cool.
And I've done a first reading of that. I'll be doing that in the new year at City Winery. I don't have the dates though. But,
don't worry about it, because we'll check you out. What website can we check out your work at?
LynnJordan.com, LynnJordan dot com.
Well,
and any of the social media. Any of those platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. I'm a big social media person.
And you've got a couple of CDs out there.
Yeah, and I have a holiday CD, and the song that you played, the Big Fat Woman song, actually is on a CD I did called A Bit of Fun. So, you know, that's
I love it.
On there.
Well, I want to encourage everybody, check out Lynn Jordan. I'm certainly a huge fan of yours now, I got to tell you. You can go to...
City Winery. That'll probably be my, you know, I've been doing a lot of group shows, but that my next show with my band, The Shivers, will be at City Winery, because that's
right.
My favorite venue, yeah.
But if you don't want to wait for then, December 19th, it's a Wednesday night, 7 o'clock, go to NavyPier.org just to check out all of what's going on at Navy Pier. It's free, folks, so you want to take the family, right? This is going to be a family show. You're going to have a great time if you're a lover of jazz and blues.
It's a great show at all, and that. And a lot of points, we're all on stage together jamming. And then Taranzo and Little Ed immediately go running through the crowd with their guitars hopping around. And, I mean, it's a very fun, festive, it's going to be a great, great party.
Well, the great, legendary Roger Ebert loved you. I love you. And I encourage everybody to check you out. Lynn Jordan, she'll be performing December 19th. A Blues Christmas over at the Ann Grand Ballroom. Thank you so much for joining me, Lynn. Fabulous. By the way, we're going to go out playing some more of your music, if you don't mind.
Woohoo! Go ahead.
Let's do it.
And now you're back from outer space. I just walked in to find you here, but that's that look upon your face. I should have changed that stupid lock. I should have made you leave your key. If I'd known for just one moment, you'd be back to bother me. Go on now, go. Walk out the door. Just turn around now, cause you're not welcome anymore. I know, weren't you? Tried to break me with goodbye. You thought I'd crumble. You thought I'd lay down and die. Well, no, not I. I will survive. Well, as long as I know how to love, I know I'll be alive.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.